listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you spent time on farms and in rural areas decades ago, you might have heard birds like meadowlarks and bobolinks often. But today, those songs are much more rare. We'll talk to the author of a book that looks at the ways that farming and wildlife shared the land in past generations and how we can recover some of that balance with different practices and policies. First, we've been checking in with some well-loved authors in the state about what they've been reading and spending their time on during the pandemic. Chloe Benjamin is the author of two novels, Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. She lives in Madison. We talked to her earlier this year, and we want to hear from you. What have you been reading lately? Have you been returning to previous favorites, enjoying something unexpected, reading some children's literature? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Chloe Benjamin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here.
Well, I've been perusing your reading list from the last couple of years. You read a lot, even in a normal year. Has 2020, though, been a time to hunker down and do even more reading maybe than usual for you?
I think it has. You know, 2020 has been this bizarre mixed experience for those of us who are lucky enough to work from home, in that you both have more time and you're incredibly distracted. So I think reading has been a really important way for me to kind of imaginatively escape for a few hours from our world, but also to engage with our world.
Before we dig into some of your reading lists, I know a lot of people have found a variety of hobbies to get into this year. Have you done some of that outside of reading?
Well, I'm a huge knitter. So I have been knitting up a storm, although I do that every year. And I also have taken up dance. There's a virtual dance teacher who I subscribe to. Her name is Melody, and the company is Melody Dance Fit. I swear this is not sponsored. But she has just such a fantastic attitude about, it's not about the steps. Don't worry about that. Shed stress. Have fun. Release something. And I've found moving my body and being in my body to be really healing this year.
I've asked a couple other writers about this. How is it affecting you as a writer during this pandemic year? The answers I've gotten from some other writers have been mixed. There are ups and downsides here. What's been your experience?
Well, I've had an interesting one. The book that I started working on after The Immortalists, I began in 2016, but early in the year prior to the presidential election. And I'm pretty tight-lipped about my projects because I don't like to talk about them until I know I can pull them off. But I will say that that one was an alternate history that ended in 2020, or would end in 2020. And I did not expect so much about 2020. And it really has thrown me because I was struggling to write essentially an alternate history in real time in circumstances that I certainly haven't processed yet. And I don't think any of us have. So I actually set that novel in a drawer, as we call it, and I started working on something else. And it is super scary. I feel a lot of grief about setting that book aside since it has been my life for the past 4 years. But I'm also trying to go with inspiration and accept that, you know, my writing life and my output is going to change because of what we're going through.
We're talking to novelist Chloe Benjamin, based in Madison. She's here to share some reading suggestions for the time of pandemic. Chloe, just looking at your list overall, a lot of variety, new books, old books, heavy books, lighter reads. Is that key to your reading success, having just a nice mix?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I read a lot of contemporary fiction because that's the genre that I'm writing in, or contemporary literary fiction. And I want to support other writers and, you know what's coming out at the moment. But it's also important for me to not lose track of, you know, books that I've been meaning to read but haven't yet. So, for instance, I read Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez this year, and it was the first time I had read him, and I had just felt terribly remiss about that for a long time. So I try to mix it up and sort of play.
I have a problem sometimes with that kind of should reads, books that I somehow have made it to this point and never read. And I don't know, it almost feels like it's a chore to do it. Did you find it, or did you get into it and find it to be enjoyable to read?
I did get into it, but I always feel that people should feel free to stop reading a book if they are not enjoying it, because there are just too many books to read in the world. So I tend to give myself 50 pages. And if it's just not hitting for me, then I say my attention can be better devoted to something else, and I'm just not the right reader. So let go of the guilt. That's what I say.
All right, well, let's start naming some more names now. I'm looking at your list. I should start with Ann Patchett and The Dutch House. She came on for a similar conversation around the time The Dutch House came out. Talk about Ann Patchett and The Dutch House on your list.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Dutch House, I read very early this year, and Ann Patchett is just wonderful. I think she has such a beautiful style and psychological acuity, and I love sibling stories. I love family stories, so that book was really a treat to dive into.
Who are some of the other authors coming out with books this year, or at least pretty fresh, 2019, who you've read and are recommending to people?
Well, one book that I am currently reading is a novel called Catherine House. This is by a debut writer named Elizabeth Thomas. And it's a fun escapist read because it's really a delicious gothic novel. And it follows a young woman who goes to a secretive 3-year quasi-college in which students are not allowed to leave the gates, and questionable scientific research may be going on. So it's really diverse, and it brings a modern sensibility to the genre. Good for cozy evenings.
Let's bring on a caller. We've got Teresa with us in Bayview. Teresa, hi.
Hi. I just want to congratulate you, Chloe. Your story, The Immortalist, is amazing. And I love that you are in Madison, my alma mater. But your detail is just phenomenal from coming from the West Coast.
Yeah. And did you want to ask for any recommendations from Chloe, Teresa?
Yes. Anything that you would recommend that's somewhat similar to that book, I would love to get into.
All right, Teresa. Oh. Thanks, Chloe. Teresa likes Chloe Benjamin. Who would you point her toward?
Well, Teresa, thank you so much. I'm incredibly touched by your kind words and thrilled that the novel resonated with you. I actually have a great list of books that I kind of see as sister books to The Immortalist. Some I read before I wrote it and some I read afterward. But here's just a few. The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer is about a group of kids who grow up wanting to be artists, and it follows them over many decades. Rebecca Mackay's The Great Believers is an incredible epic that has to do with the AIDS epidemic, and I just thought it was marvelous. Pachinko by Min Jin Lee is a family story that is set over multiple generations. And all of these books have a lot of heart and beautiful prose, so I hope you like them.
Thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Peter now with us in Viroqua. Peter, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, Chloe, that I haven't read you, but hearing you speak makes me want to. So I'm going to, your book is what, The Immortals?
The Immortalist.
Yeah. So I'll look that one up and dig into it. But I wanted to mention that one of the just blessings of being a parent when my children got older, I have two sons, 19 and 16, and my oldest son recommended Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind, and then the sequel, The Wise Man's Fear. And I was sort of reticent to read them. And, one's like 670 pages and the other's like 1,000 or whatever. And I got into them. And thanks to my son, I just had this amazing read. And this is another Wisconsin author. So thanks for being on the show, and I'll look forward to reading your book.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Peter recommending Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss. Do you find yourself seeking out, Chloe, people who are local to the area or to the state?
Well, that's always just a wonderful bonus. I think, Wisconsin has a really incredible arts community, and Madison, where I did my MFA, has so many wonderful writers who live in town. So now, of course, that I'm on the spot, my mind is blanking. But actually, I can tell you one book that I absolutely loved was written by Judith Clare Mitchell. She was actually my graduate school mentor, and she's also an incredible writer. And this book follows three sisters who are writing a joint suicide note on the last day of the 20th century. And it's funny. Wow. So you might not think so, but that's a really fantastic one.
Peter, thanks for calling in. We're talking to author Chloe Benjamin, Madison-based author of The Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. We're sharing some great book recommendations, and we want to hear from you. What have you been reading lately? Have you ventured into genres that you're not usually drawn to? What's on your to-read list that you're excited about? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Madison-based author Chloe Benjamin. She's the author of the novels Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. And we want to hear from you. Tell us what you're reading or something you've enjoyed reading so far this year. What's on your reading list for 2021? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We heard from a few listeners earlier this year on Facebook. Mary said, I just read The Stationery Shop, a very sweet love story, plus interesting parallels between today's election and the one in Iran in the 1950s. Marie says she's reading books on Wisconsin wildlife and nature. Deborah says, Anxious People by Frederick Backman made her laugh out loud several times and was a good human relationship story. And Brandy says, The Autobiography of King Henry VIII by Margaret George. She says, I love how Henry will give one account of events, but then his fool, Will, sets the record straight. And we want to hear from you. Tell us what you're reading or something you've enjoyed reading so far this year. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go back to our callers now. Sandy is with us in New Berlin. Sandy, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about a book that I just finished yesterday that I was so thrilled that I had read. It's by Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, The Great Migration, you know, and kind of taught the whole country about what that was. I think she won a Pulitzer for that, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so this her new book is Cast, C-A-S-T-E. And it is, I'm looking at the cover here now, The Origins of Our Discontent. So she explains, what she really does is explain how our culture and our society is organized. And it's a very hard thing to see when you're in the middle of it, but she is such a good writer and just makes it a pleasure to read. And she does it in all different ways. She does personal narrative. She does essay. She does research reporting. It's just excellent.
Thank you so much for the suggestion. I appreciate it. Do you have, Chloe, nonfiction or essay on your radar?
Ooh, I do. I am currently reading Underland by Robert McFarlane, and it's essentially a book about underground spaces. So there's a section on the catacombs in Paris. There's a section on sea caves, on a mine, a former mine in South Dakota, in which scientists are trying to find cosmic particles. So it's really fascinating, and I would highly recommend it to anyone this year.
Thanks again, Sandy, for that call. I want to get to some more frequently appearing names on your reading list. Tana French, I see you've got a 2020 book, The Witch Elm, but if I scroll down into your reading history, she pops up a lot. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I do love Tana French. So she is a crime writer, and she lives in Ireland. I believe that she's actually American, but she writes beautiful crime novels that are set in Ireland. And, you know, being a writer, I love a good plot, but the language also has to be there for me to truly become attached to a book. And she's just a beautiful writer and a brilliant plotter. And her books focus on a squad of detectives in what it's called the Dublin Murder Squad. And so each book takes place from the perspective of a different person on the squad. So it's a lot of fun to see how those relationships play out as well.
And I'll say I read one of her books set in Dublin, as you say, and I'm not always a crime and police procedural kind of reader. And I really liked it. She does have a way with telling the story beyond just the plot, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then who else? Let's see. How about rereading? I know I think some of your books you go back and reread from time to time. What does it take for a book to get a second look from you?
You know, that's a great question. And I think in part it comes down to atmosphere. If I'm going to read a book for a second or third time, it's because I want to live in that world. So some of the books that I reread are actually ones that inspired me as a young person. I've been rereading the Harry Potter series, but also one of my favorite books of all time or series of all time is Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. I read that when I was 13 for the first time, and it still impacts me just as much today. It's about consciousness and religion and the cosmos and knowledge. And it's they're the kind of young adult books that translate just as powerfully to adults. So I've been rereading those books in anticipation of his new trilogy, which also takes place in the same universe. So for any fantasy lovers, Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials and the new trilogy, The Book of Dust, is just fantastic.
I'm sometimes a little nervous to go back to a cherished childhood read memory in case it doesn't hold up and it kind of ruins it for me. It sounds like that's not the experience you've had, at least with that series.
No, you know, and I think that's when you really know that a book is truly special to you. Another book actually that I reread this year was A Wrinkle in Time. And I bet a lot of readers will recognize that when it was published in the 60s. And it speaks just as powerfully to me today as, you know, it did in its time. So that's, again, you know, a young adult book, but one that I think really transcends age and all kinds of other boundaries.
We are talking to Madison-based novelist Chloe Benjamin, author of Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalist. She's sharing some great reading suggestions for us for a pandemic time or any other time. Another name on your list, I've read some of her older books, not her newest ones, I think, Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh, yeah. I love her writing. So she's best known for Station 11, which came out in 2014, but that was actually her fourth book. And I love her story because it reminds me a little bit of mine in that my first book was what we call a quieter publication. It didn't reach as wide of an audience as my second book. And so I kind of feel a kinship when authors have a book that reaches that wide audience, but not their debut. But beyond that, I just find her to be somebody who's, I mean, language is absolutely beautiful, and her plotting is also brilliant. Her first three books are actually kind of in the noir category, and then Station 11 and her most recent book, The Glass Hotel, move into kind of literary fiction with a speculative component.
Yeah, what's up? What's The Glass Hotel about? I'm interested in reading it. I have not checked it out myself because I really enjoyed Station 11 and then went back and read some of her earlier ones.
So The Glass Hotel is essentially about a young woman who kind of becomes a drifter, takes on a number of different jobs and kind of moves through a sort of underworld, and then meets a very, very wealthy man who turns out to be running a Ponzi scheme. And this is not giving away anything because I'm pretty sure this is on the jacket of the book, but it essentially is, you know, moves back and forth in time through their relationship before, during, and after the collapse of the scheme. So it has a lot to do with money, which I think, you know, literary fiction doesn't talk about enough, or, you know, people don't write it about enough. But she just brings her just a real humanity and compassion to everybody that she writes, even if the characters are doing terrible things.
Now, here's one on your list this year that's kind of a kid doing his own thing here. George Bernard Shaw, St. Joan, his take on the Joan of Arc tale. How did that one find its way into your list this year?
You know, I read that for research for the book that I had been working on that I set aside. But I'm still glad that I did, because it was a great read. And a fun personal connection is that my mom, who is a stage actor, actually played Joan of Arc when she was young. And so I was able to ask her about her experience of that show. And one thing that she told me is that she would rehearse bound, and so that she had the experience of imprisonment in her body. So, so that was just a really neat layer as I was reading that play.
Now, what is on your stack, your to-read stack? You probably can't recommend quite yet, but you're excited to crack open when you're done with your current reads.
Yeah. You know, there's a book that I would actually wanted to bring up because it's called The Power of Ritual, Turning Everyday Activities into Soulful Practices. It's by Casper Terkile, who is a Harvard Divinity School fellow, and he's also a co-host of a podcast called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And the idea behind this book is turning, you know, these everyday actions like walking the dog or pouring yourself a cup of coffee or smelling a scent can be made sacred and can connect you to a spirituality that doesn't have to rely on an organized religion or a church. And I don't think it's a book that pushes away those things, but it just imagines a kind of sacredness of the everyday. And I think that just really resonated with me during this time when we feel pretty isolated. Many of us are in our homes. So I'm really looking forward to reading that.
That sounds like a great book for this time and a good place to leave it. Chloe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
That was Chloe Benjamin, the author of two novels, Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. She lives in Madison. She joined us to talk about what she's been reading during the pandemic. You can keep sharing your book recommendations by tweeting us at CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a book that looks at the ways that farming and wildlife shared the land in past generations and how we can recover some of that balance with different practices and policies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, read both fun and informative digital articles, and get the latest from the WPR News Department. Check it out at WPR.org. Now, if you spent time in rural areas decades ago, there are probably sounds and particular species that stand out in your memory. But chances are, if you're still there or go back to visit, you're seeing and hearing fewer of those creatures. And it turns out that there are a lot of different factors that have made it harder for wildlife and farming to share land together. And we want to hear from you. Do you have memories of when a wider variety of birds and animals were present on farmland in Wisconsin? Have you seen that change over the years? If you're a farmer yourself, do you try to keep your farm friendly to wildlife? If so, what do you do? If you're not able to, what kind of support would help? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know. Our next guest says there's a lot we can do to feed people while still keeping a place for wildlife on and around farmland. John Marsliff is a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and is the author or co-author of a lot of books on environmental topics. His most recent is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. John, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, I want to give a sound to the bird in your title there, an eastern meadowlark. Here's a listen. And that's a bird that is an emblem for a lot of the changes you've seen going on when it comes to wildlife in our agricultural areas. What is it about meadowlarks that stand out for you?
Well, a couple of things. They're pretty much obligate grassland nesters, and at least during the breeding season, that's where we see them up here in North America. Because they're so closely tied to grasslands, their populations have plummeted over the last several decades by up to 70%. By some estimates. So they're a flagship for a species that is in decline in response to the way we've treated our grassland environments.
And growing up looking at farmland all the time, it the change that's happened may not stand out to us. Can you talk about, over the last couple of centuries, how we've changed our grassland ecosystems around the United States?
Sure. And first, I think your point that these changes don't stand out so strongly to us is a good one. And the meadowlark's an example of that as well. You probably, most listeners have probably still heard or seen meadowlarks in the past years, but their numbers are greatly reduced. And that's because we've done things like plowed up an awful lot of the prairie and planted it with cereal crops. And in the upper Midwest, that's mostly corn and soybean as we get a little further south as well. So the change in that perennial grass to a annual cereal grain that's harvested and disturbed each year has reduced the ability of birds to nest in that environment.
And you say, you write that even within agriculture in North America, we've had that change to that monoculture, these huge crops. In the past, was it more possible for wildlife, not just the meadowlark, but other species to survive on and around American farmland?
I would say it wasn't even more possible. It was exactly the norm there. When we had smaller farms, we had hedgerows between them. We had waterways and ponds that were left. Places that were difficult to work just weren't worked. And that was good for wildlife. They could find shelter there. There was less of a human footprint on the land.
But the big contradiction, the difficulty at the core of your book is we've got a lot of people on this planet. We keep having more and more people on the planet. How do we feed them while still leaving room for this kind of wildlife, either to live on our farmland or to live near it? How do you see that struggle shaping up in the 21st century?
I think it's going to be a struggle, and I think it's one of the grand challenges we face as a species. Unless we want to be left alone on this planet with our food, we need to do something to allow other forms of life to exist with us in these settings. And people talk about two basic strategies. The one you referred to of basically intensifying our use of the agricultural land so that we can set aside more natural lands for wildlife. And the other is to share our farmlands, not farm them so intensively, but kind of step back to the way it was in the 60s, 50s, where there was a lighter touch, more natural habitat interspersed with farmland, and a different attitude of farmers to enjoy and look for ways to coexist with the wildlife on their lands.
We're talking to John Marsliff about his new book, In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And John, I want to make it clear, in your book, you're not making farmers out to be the bad guy here. You see them as people wanting to steward their land, their soil, and their region. And you find a lot of them doing innovative things to make their farming practices more sustainable. Do you see a lot of hope coming from farmers themselves to be part of the solutions to the questions you're raising?
I absolutely do. All the farmers that I talk with, and I went to many farms here in the U.S. and Costa Rica, and in all of those cases, the farmers I met were enthusiastic about the animals and native plants on their lands, but they're faced with an economic challenge of making a living, and to do so in some settings requires them basically to work the land in a way that's not as conducive to wildlife as it once was. But they all look for ways to do it, and I found many very innovative, as you say, strategies to do so.
You point toward past success stories in dealing with challenges to the way we farm, and one is the reaction to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, where farming practices were changed in kind of one of the agricultural heartlands of the United States to resist future droughts. Does that inspire you that as big as the challenges are, there is hope today?
Well, I think whenever we face those sorts of challenges, we do tend to rise to the occasion and innovate our way out of it. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to do that. It's more difficult when we're also trying to do that and conserve species that perhaps some feel are not so necessary for our being. I don't see it that way, but that makes it a more difficult situation than just growing more food for more people. But yeah, the Dust Bowl saw lots of conservation efforts put into place to save topsoil, to reduce its loss from wind, and that included planting of trees, leaving some unplowed areas, reducing tilling in general. All of those things are beneficial for the health of the land and for the wildlife that depends on it.
You look to a lot of people and institutions for solutions here. One of those groups is the consumer, people who eat food, which is, I guess, all of us. What kind of things would you invite people who eat food to think about when it comes to supporting this kind of sustainability?
Yeah, I think we can all play an important part here. And one of the first things I'd ask you to think about is, who's your farmer? Do you know them? Have you met them? Do you know how they treat their land and how they treat it with respect to harboring wildlife? I met a woman whose dad is a banana picker in Costa Rica, and I will only buy organic bananas now because of the stories from him of being doused with pesticides while he was working in the field of traditional big ag down there. So knowing the sorts of stresses that are on the farmer, how they cope with them, that can point us to buying certain types of food. And in general, one of the most important things we can do is think carefully about our choice of meat, especially. It has a huge effect on the environment, from climate change to the crops that are grown that are fed to our cattle in particular. So, again, from my standpoint, the more we can do to wean ourselves from grain-fed beef, the better we can do for the environment as well.
And then you look toward creating incentives for farmers with things like a conservation program in the U.S. Farm Bill. What kind of things would you like to see more of?
Yeah, that became very apparent as I talked with farmers that had a choice to put some of their lands into the Conservation Reserve Program or other sorts of programs like that, that allows them to fallow land or to plant it in ways that are more conducive to wildlife. They simply can't afford to do that. They make a lot less per acre than they would if they planted it in soy or corn. So rectifying that, paying for conservation and making it a fair trade to conserve versus to harvest the area is, I think, critical. And those of us who have a voice in our governing bodies should try to make that pitch strongly to them.
We're talking to ornithologist John Marsliff, professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. We're talking about his book, In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And we want to hear from you. Would you be willing to pay more for food that you know is raised in a way that supports wildlife? How about reducing the amount of corn-fed meat that you eat? If you're a farmer, what incentives or support would help you to be able to steward your land in a way that encourages wildlife? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with John Marsliff. He's a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. His book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. We'll go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living out on a farm that was in the middle of big-time soy and corn production, and we were getting dived by chemicals every hour of every day during the summer. It was horrible. But I bought a house in the city, and I think that people are living in some kind of despair about what they can do. I bought a house that's on a lot. It's 150 feet by 150 feet. I am digging up every speck of grass on this lot, and I am planting prairie. And I am going to invite this little oasis to be a place where wildlife and pollinators can come and be happy. And I think if everybody that could do that, because there are restrictions on it, but if everybody can do that, it's a little thing that you can do to make yourself feel better about this. You're not like just lost in this huge industrial farming complex that you can't control.
Chris, thanks for the call. John, she's doing it in her lot, but is there room for farmers to create those spaces, whether they're buffer zones or reserve areas, enough to make a difference?
Absolutely. And in at your home is also a great place to start. There's no doubt about that. Every little bit helps. But on the farm, you've got more land to work with. So again, places that are difficult to work, point rows, those little triangles that are hard to get the plow down, leaving those and letting places like that go back to nature. The areas that aren't hit by the irrigation wheels can be places where a little bit of prairie can grow. And some of the birds, the smaller birds like savanna sparrows, can get by in small patches of prairie. Meadowlarks need a little bit larger patch.
Thanks for that call, Chris. Pete emailed us from Reedsburg. Pete says, I'm 65 and grew up in rural Richland County. In those years, birds like meadowlarks, whippoorwills, and red-headed woodpeckers were so common you barely noticed them. Today, Pete says, it's a memorable day when you see or hear even one. On the other hand, Pete says, hawks of all kinds were not very common back then. Today, they're all over the countryside, maybe because we stopped killing them indiscriminately. Shows we can make a difference if we try. What do you think of what Pete had to say, John?
Yeah, actually, it's absolutely right. Hawks have increased, but not the ones that require the grassland, like the northern harrier. That hawk has declined along with the other grassland birds. But with banning of DDT, hawk populations in general have increased greatly, and that's been a boon to that group of birds for sure. And it, as he says, it shows that some simple changes can, even though they seem difficult, imagine banning pesticides like DDT now. That change had profound effects.
Let's go back to our callers. Carlin is with us in Waukesha. Carlin, hi.
Hi. Just want to put in a plug for the monarch butterfly, because I think, the Environmental Defense Fund and everybody, I read information about it. The population has decreased by 90%, and it's the milkweed destruction. And that's where it used to live, was between the fields, the farmers' fields, and along our, along the roads, roadways and everything. And because of herbicides and because of the way the farmers have to farm now, we don't have all that habitat anymore. So they're suffering a lot, and we need to plant more milkweed. So just putting in a plug for that, too, because...
Carlin, thanks a lot for the call. I know there's this effort in Wisconsin and elsewhere, John, to get farmers and road departments and homeowners do exactly what Carlin's talking about, bring back those milkweed patches.
Yeah, and a common place was in the ditches along roads, and that's an easy target for conservation, and the verges in the roads even. That's an easy target. It's not one that's being farmed intensively right now, and a little bit of change there could, again, make a big difference.
Thanks for that call. Back to your calls. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I live in a rural community. I'm surrounded by farms, and I've lived here for 30 years, and I remember when we first moved here, I used to see a lot more meadowlarks and bobolinks and birds that are sort of nesters, grass nesters, but they've started to cut the hay so early these days. So I'm not blaming them. That's probably a necessity on their part. But this early harvesting of hay, the first cutting, is usually before the nesting birds, grass nesting birds, have a chance to fledge and leave the nest. So a lot of them are killed in that process. And then I used to also hear a lot of whippoorwills, and I haven't heard a whippoorwill, I bet you it's been 10 years. And I think that has to do with the wetland destruction, which is also, wetlands being converted to different types of land use. And the other bird that I've disappeared from seeing very often are red-headed woodpeckers. So there are many birds that are disappearing. It's just that a lot of people either don't notice or, I guess they just don't notice.
Well, thanks for the call. And, John, I wonder sometimes as you're talking to people, do they have that moment like, yeah, I never thought about it. I used to see these guys, these birds all the time. Now I never do.
Yes, all the time. I think, and especially a bird like the bobolink, is another great example, like the meadowlark. But the bobolink is a species that kids grew up with 40, 50 years ago, and it was common. It was kind of a herald of spring, and it was looked forward to seeing that bird back, and that's been missing. And, in fact, it is because of these early harvests of hay fields and some of the grasslands that are harvested for cattle feed as well. But there are some very innovative programs out there targeting these species, paying farmers to delay their harvest in California and in New England. This is working well. So farmers, again, if we incentivize the right sorts of things, they're more than happy to do this and still are able to make a living. And the bobolinks and other species are able to survive as well.
Willem, thanks for that call. We're talking to John Marsliff. His new book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. One thing that struck me in your book, John, I think this is in Nebraska, not just a decline in species diversity, but in the number of humans in farming communities. We hear about rural decline in Wisconsin. I think you were in Nebraska where there were these once thriving, vibrant farming communities. Now they have way fewer people and way less going on thanks to the way agriculture has changed.
Yeah, I went to Ong, Nebraska, a small place that I would never have heard of except that my mother-in-law grew up there as a farm kid. And boy, it was a great place back in the day. As we drove through with her, you could see the life just drained out of her as we looked at the churches that were abandoned, all the abandoned buildings, all the favorite places and memories of her childhood basically had just been left to decay as people have moved to cities, as farms are being owned by fewer and fewer people. Big corporations don't have all the houses on the land that used to be there that supported the smaller individual farmer and the need for these smaller rural towns. So there's a dramatic shift across the middle U.S. for sure.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mary Kay is with us now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi, I called the DNR last year. The birds and the bees are disappearing because of pesticide applications, toxic pesticide applications. They don't want anything to do with that land. So when we have safer pesticides, which I'm sure the DNR has already issued, we're going to see them come back.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. John, just that direct impact, do we see that of pesticides on the wildlife?
I agree with that. In Nebraska, I plotted that trend out because we measure the number of acres that are treated with pesticides each year in the U.S., and that number has increased dramatically in association with decline of grassland birds. But we have also greatly reduced the amount of habitat out there. So if they're hand in hand, and I agree, safer pesticides, if such a thing exists, would be good. But there's a lot of natural ways to deal with pests, and a lot of the farmers I talked with are employing those, from having bluebirds and owls on their property to eat pests to other sorts of plants that have pesticide benefits.
You refer to a Wisconsinite, Aldo Leopold, a few times in your book, including his charge to remake agriculture in a way that increases the, what he called, stability, integrity, and beauty of the planet. How do you see that spirit maybe being a guidepost to the future?
I think it'd be the most fantastic guidepost we could have. And I met some farmers here. I thought I was talking to Leopold a few times with the way these people work their land. They really see it as a community, not solely a commodity, which, again, is an important point that Leopold made. So I think it'd be a fabulous standard for us to try to live up to. If only more of us did, I think the world would be a much better place.
John, in our last couple of minutes, it seems like it would be easy to be pessimistic. We've got this growing demand for food with more people, concern over climate change, agriculture's impact on it, how it's going to affect our farming in the future. Having gone through the experience of researching and writing this book, do you still feel hopeful?
I am hopeful. I see some solutions out there. There are some very interesting modeling exercises done to project how much we need to change to have a positive effect on the Earth's ecosystems. Certainly, we're having a huge and mostly negative effect now, but as more and more people understand the small things they can do to make a difference, I think they will, and I'm hopeful that will generate a large change in our natural world.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
John Marsliff is a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. Here's a New Year's resolution for you. Keep up with what's going on Wisconsin Public Radio. Follow the latest news at WPR.org. Join us at the Ideas Network Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Central Time WPR. A lot of great ways to keep in touch with Wisconsin and the world. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk with the author of a book who says that while being an outsider can feel scary and lonely at times, we should embrace our weirdness and appreciate the unique perspectives it can give us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.